Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated history episodes, and we also have episodes where we sit down with filmmakers, authors, politicians, and historians, and we talk about wars in history. Today's guest is Roel Koninendijk, and again, I hope I'm not butchering that. He's a Dutch historian based in the UK who's an expert on classical Greek warfare, so this is really exciting. And you also might know him as one of the moderators on Reddit r/AskHistorians, that subreddit, which is like, I probably spend too much of my life on that subreddit. So and he's written very widely on the subject of the ancient world. And he is also the author of today's book, Classical Greek Tactics, A Cultural History. Roel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Emily. I'm glad to be here.
Yes. So, all right, let's just kind of launch into this overall. Everybody has this idea, whether it's from movies or probably just movies, but about what Greek warfare looked like and what it was. But you kind of argue that it's not quite what we think. Can you give us just a little overview of what we might have wrong about Greek warfare?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So this is a kind of big question. I think it's about a decade and a half of work. I'm going to try and summarize. But fundamentally, I mean, so the Greek world is obviously a world of really small states, right? So there's a lot of different states that are very frequently in conflict with each other. You don't have this big nation state of Greece. Instead, you have hundreds, literally hundreds of these tiny states. Some of them are, you know, quite big. The biggest ones are about the size of like Luxembourg, you know, micro states of today's world, but quite large compared to the other Greek states. They wage war a lot. If they have a sort of major enemies or if they have sort of power over others, then they can get together these large coalitions, but for the most part, their conflicts involve, you know, individual city-states or regions sort of going up against each other. And the way that the principle that sort of underpins these wars is not the kind of standing armies that we know nowadays, sort of waging war on each other on behalf of a civilian population and a civilian government. This is really because the communities are so small, and because they have this fairly egalitarian participatory system of government, for the most part, whether they're oligarchies or democracies or other forms, people are very closely involved in the decision that the states make. There is not really a government as such. There isn't like a fourth power or bureaucracy that runs the place. They're just individual citizens who hold magistracies. And people decide for themselves, like, we are going to war. And then it's them who have to actually do it. So it's the citizen body that is then levied to go and fight these wars. And that's obviously, I mean, we all understand the idea of the militia. We still have a lot of that. So modern countries, obviously, when they have conscription, things like that, there are systems that are similar to it.
Yeah.
But we don't quite have anything comparable to the scale of this, right? You have the entire male population, not just citizens, also resident foreigners and the enslaved, everybody who is an adult male who can hold a weapon, essentially, gets drafted into these armies at time of need. But when there isn't a need, when there isn't a conflict going on, there is no military, right? There, no one is in the army until the army is created for a specific purpose. And so you're getting this environment, which is just radically different from how we perceive war.
Totally.
Right.
That is really hard to imagine. That is, even with the militia, like you're saying, like there was still this like overlordly government that wasn't going to fight. They were just telling you to gather the militia. That's hard to think.
And it's weird when you recognize just how closely involved these people are. Like they elect their own generals. And then, you know, in Athens, if the generals don't do a good job, then those same people are essentially marching straight from the battlefield to the assembly to denounce these generals. I mean, it's people they know, right? It's people from their own neighborhoods that they're putting in these positions. And so they're very, very personally involved. And that also means, you know, they're the ones doing the fighting, they're the ones taking the risks, and they're the ones deciding what kind of purpose that is for.
Right.
So it's very involved. You know, it means that a huge section of the population is directly involved in this. But it also means that, you know, you're using ordinary people to wage war, right? These are not soldiers. These have not been, generally speaking, we have no evidence that any of them are trained for war. There's just kind of, you have to develop a way of war that can work, based on just participation, right? As long as you're willing to do your bit, right? That's essentially it. So as long as you're willing to do your bit, you can do what the state needs you to do. You can do something that will help it achieve its aims, whether that's defense or offense, you know, whether it's strategic or just winning a battle, something like that. You have to figure out a way to use this kind of model of the total citizen militia, essentially, in a way that's effective. And that leads to some very quirky things that I've been trying to emphasize. Like, these are not armies like we know them. These are not wars like we know them. This is really quite a different historical environment.
And I'm going to ask you about that, because it is so, like, that definitely seems like there's part of it that's like, oh, so they wouldn't be kind of needlessly sending people off to die as much as if you don't have to fight yourself. But at the same time, like, that also does happen. And, you know, like you're saying, these aren't trained soldiers. So it's kind of like,
Yeah, there's a real conflict there, I think. Like, we would assume that if you let people decide for themselves whether or not to go to war, they wouldn't do it, right? Because we all know.
Never, yeah.
Certainly the Greeks also, like, from the earliest literature, from Homer onwards, you know, you have people saying war is terrible, war is a nightmare. You know, the damage you cause and the risks you run and the people who are, you know, dragged into it and who are losing everything, it's horrible. They all know it. Yeah. And yet they seem to find it very easy to decide to go to war. It's absolutely within their toolbox. You know, if they're thinking about policy, they're thinking about war and peace. Absolutely. They don't have any hesitation. So there's a very different way of looking at it as well.
Yeah.
Which is, on one hand, you are literally deciding for yourself, I want to go to this, you know, to this war, apparently. But it doesn't stop them. It doesn't make them think, okay, well, in that case, let's all get together and say this will never happen again. They have the opportunity and they just won't do it. They will keep on using war as an instrument of policy.
Do you think there was an element of, like, let's say you go into 16th, 17th, and sometimes the 17th, 18th century warfare, there was this idea that people knew war was terrible, but there was also kind of this noble romanticizing about it sometimes. Do you think in ancient Greece they had the same thing where they're like, for my city state, I will do this, but like,
absolutely. Yeah. So that seems to be what motivates them, right? So there's this idea of communal duty. So there's this civic obligation to do it, and you don't want to fall short of that. I mean, people will know, right? And as I said, you know, if it's your entire neighborhood turning out as a unit, they will know.
They
won't let you forget it if you don't behave right. That's one part of it. The other part is that they genuinely did believe that it brought glory, right? To behave well in war, and that having stories told about you and what you did in a conflict is one of the ways to, I mean, to put it sort of very simply, to achieve immortality. But right, the idea that people will remember you in a good way, that's one of the things that really inspires them, that really, really motivates them. You know, drives them to do things that we might think are, you know, objectively not. High on sort of self-preservation skills, but they also do things because they, you know, because there is this understanding that it can, for a community, be a really important thing to distinguish itself, rather than necessarily even to survive. You know, that there are certainly communities in the ancient world that choose death over dishonor, right? That kind of idea is not quite pervasive. Otherwise, people wouldn't have to write about it so much and advertise the idea. But certainly it happened. You know, certainly you have these communities that, you know, that will seriously consider whether it's better to survive at all or to, you know, to preserve something about themselves, which to broadcast something about themselves, even if it means, you know, that's the last thing they ever do.
Yeah, that is so wild. I feel like that, you know, you see that in a lot of different societies, especially, you know, 1800s and before, you know, a little bit afterwards, but not like the ancient world was on a totally different level, I feel like, with that kind of thing.
It's really different. Like, obviously, you know, the last stands have been inspiring stories to warriors and soldiers, right? They continue to be, right? Like, so many modern units are inspired still by the stories of, you know, Thermopylae, things like that. I mean, so many units around the world try to use those symbols and those slogans and try to express something around themselves, saying, we also would, you know, die for the cause. But it's different when dying for the cause means literally you're standing on the wall of your city, right? And if your defense fails, everyone will die or be sold into slavery. And, you know, there's debate over which fate is worse. And that is genuinely something that occurs in the Greek literature that survives. And so it's really this sense of, like, you're so close to total annihilation. You're not just talking about yourself and what you might do as an army unit. You're talking about your whole community, survival or destruction. And still, you know, they are sometimes willing to say, okay, well, that's how I'm going to do it. You know, we're not just going to...
So wild.
Yeah.
So the movies aren't like that far off, you know, with that kind of, give them that.
And I mean, obviously, you know, even the movie 300, fantastical and wild as it is, I mean, it's giving you the bare bones of a real event. I mean, In fact, it's only telling you the Spartans died, but there are actually several other communities whose detachments in that battle also stayed and fought to the death. So the Thespians, the Thebans, although they surrendered in the end. And then there's a later source tells us that there were some Mycenaeans there. This is a very small community at this point. You know, it used to be the big city of the, or the big fortress city of the Greek world in the Bronze Age. By this time, it's a tiny little village. But they had like 80 guys there. And they still fought to the death. You know, they also decided that was the right move. So you absolutely have this, that understanding. It's just most of them do it. Most of them will choose to survive. That is, both human instinct and good strategic sense. But there's absolutely occasions where they decide, no, this, you know, what we should do here is make a stand, even if it means, you know, not coming home.
Mm. So, okay, I want to ask a little bit about the Greek warfare tactics. So you also talk about how it's not maybe as like basic and primitive as we think. There's complexity and there's layers there. And can you tell us like just, how complicated are we talking an average Greek battle would be?
I mean, it's pretty simple in a way, because as I said, you know, you have these militias, you have these very large units of essentially untrained troops. And so you have to keep things pretty straightforward. So in terms of infantry combat, I think people tend to overstate how complex it is. I mean, you're really just lining these guys up and telling them, like, go against the guys over there. When complexity comes in is that people assume that that's all that's going on. You just have these heavy infantrymen on both sides, right? These guys called hoplites. They are basically spearmen. They have a very large round shield and that identifies them. That's how you know that, oh, this is Greek heavy infantry. There's a section of the population that can afford that kind of armor. They're buying it for themselves. Those are the ones you're lining up in your sort of main battle line. But there's other things going on around that. Like these generals aren't satisfied to just let things be decided that way. So they have their light infantry. They have their cavalry as well. They have mounted troops.
Okay.
And increasingly in the period that I studied, they are trying to figure out how they can use those instruments to win in a way that means they don't have to, you know, depend on chance, depend on that encounter between very equal forces. And seeing how that's going to turn out when, in fact, it's basically a coin toss, essentially. So they don't want to rely on that. So they're trying to develop better ways of using the instruments at their disposal to try and, you know, to make it more predictable, make have more
strategy.
Exactly. Well,
okay. Did they actually have like a military doctrine, like, you know, in the way that we do today, or, you know, like these are the rules, this is what we're doing?
It's a really interesting question. Some scholars have asked themselves that, not enough, I think, because it's actually very, very hard to pin down. I tried to look into this myself, like trying to figure out if there is something that you could call Greek strategy. There is, the best evidence is for Athens in the imperial period, so in the 5th century BC, where you do have a clear sense that what they're doing fits into an overall scheme of like, well, how do you support your own power? How do you expand your strategic interests, et cetera? But most of the other states, you just don't have any good evidence that they're thinking about this in terms of structure, in terms of policy. Like, there are some ways in which you could argue that, you know, there a pattern emerges, so to speak.
Okay.
And it's not explicit.
Okay. That's what we're looking for. Okay.
Right. It's not like somebody tells you, like, okay, this is what we need to do. And so in some cases, you can probably point that out. But especially, like I said, Athens is kind of the exception to that. But what you're getting to, the reason why that doesn't exist is because, again, there's no professional military. So no one is sitting around the military academy saying, this is what we should do, or how should we go about this? How do we train an officer to understand our general plan, our general approach to things? There's nothing like that. So insofar as anybody was thinking about, like, how do we fight wars? How do we win wars? How do we achieve our policy aims? That was happening almost informally, right? That's happening between these guys who are sort of wealthy citizens who might get elected or appointed to high office or to generalships.
Yeah.
And they're talking to each other and saying, right, how did you do this?
Okay. One thing I want to ask is, okay, so typically people, myself included, even right or wrong, tend to like kind of conflate a little bit of Roman warfare, ancient Roman warfare with Greek warfare. If, let's say, a Greek fighter was dropped into a Roman legion, would he fit in, or would he be like, what the hell's going on?
Kind of depends on the time. I mean, obviously there's differences in equipment, but I think the biggest difference between those forces is that from about the first century BC, that Roman legion is essentially professional, right? So that's a military that is on campaign for years at a time, that essentially perceives itself as an army of soldiers rather than as people who have been sort of temporarily drafted for a particular objective or whatever, and that attach themselves very strongly. I mean, this is this feature of the Roman army, in particular in the late Republic. They attach themselves to individual commanders who are essentially become their patrons, right? They are the ones who essentially decide where they go, what they do there, and how they can make their, you know, make their fortune as soldiers. And you see that on a few occasions in the Greek world, because you have some mercenary armies, right? Okay, that's the limited professionalism that you get.
That's interesting.
Most of these guys, if they're citizens fighting for their city, there just wouldn't be that sense of permanence, that sense of like, oh, this is my livelihood, right?
Right.
So it's very different in that sense. And also, obviously, because of that, the Roman army starts just taking things much more seriously. You know, they're much more organized in terms of their logistics, their encampments, their military organization. They devote much more time to preparation, training, equipment. They have a lot more funds available for that kind of thing, just because the Roman state is so much bigger and their territory control is vast.
Yeah. And then like Caesar can go out for 23 years or whatever to Gaul and just stay there with the military.
With tens of thousands of people, right? Like that's the kind of thing that in the Greek world is just not feasible, because you wouldn't have, you know, don't have the kind of means to support something like that. So I think, you know, people tend to sort of start from the equipment and say, well, these guys have spears and these guys have swords, whatever. But the more important thing really, I think, is that, you know, that Roman military has started to think of itself as an organization of a different kind.
Yeah.
And that is really taking seriously how to be an effective war machine. Whereas most Greek armies exist for a few days and then disappear, right?
Like
they have a purpose that's very specific, and they're just a bunch of citizens getting together to do that job. And of course, there are more and more exceptions to that. As these Greek states grow and get more financial means, they start sending out, you know, getting mercenaries in and sending troops out, for instance, like sieges, the longer operations, that sort of thing. But that is not the norm, right? That's not what normally happens with these
armies. It almost feels like the Roman Empire and that aspect of the somewhat professional military was very much an anomaly, because even into the Napoleonic Wars is when you start to see professional armies develop. And like, that's a long gap where it's like rare to have a professional army. And,
this is this constant problem throughout history, right? Like, how do you get an armed force that's effective? Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, the Greek system, it emphasizes one particular aspect of it. Like, what do you want? Numbers, right? If you want large numbers, levy the entire population. Doesn't matter if they're very good at fighting. You will have a lot of these guys.
Throw them out there.
Right. And they're very committed to the cause. But already in the classical period that I studied, towards the end of that, you get the rise of Macedon. They also technically have a citizen levy, but they muster part of that levy as a professional force, and they keep it in the field at all times. And that, it turns out to be a vastly more effective fighting force than any of these militias.
Yeah.
For reasons that seem fairly obvious to us. You know, they're much better trained. They're much better prepared. They can act more quickly.
Sure.
They can serve around the year. And they really know what they're doing because of their long experience. And that turns out to be decisive.
Okay. Before I forget, one of my absolute favorite questions to ask people is about sources. And this is going way further. You know, normally I'm talking to people in that study 14th century or 13th century or even 20th century in there. But oh my God, so we're talking about ancient sources. How hard is it to find, are there primary sources? Or do you have to rely on secondary? Like, what's the deal?
Yeah, you absolutely do have primary sources, thankfully. I mean, this is one of the reasons why we can study the Greek and the Roman world, is because quite a lot of the literary evidence survives. So I say quite a lot. It's like 1%, but still.
It's shocking.
It's, you know, horrendous amounts were lost forever, but some of it was through diligent copying over thousands of years.
Oh my God.
So in a lot of cases,
surprising.
Yeah. So our earliest manuscripts of them will date to the Middle Ages, but if we trust that they have been accurately copied over, then they go back much further. We know their origins are much further back. And so those are literary accounts. Those are people who are writing histories and writing speeches and writing, you know, tragedies or philosophical treatises or even military treatises sometimes. That survive. And some of them were very popular still in the early modern period. You know, people were reading them for information, not just to study history, but to learn how to be a soldier.
That's crazy.
And so that's something that emerges out of the ancient world. And then, of course, you have archaeology. I mean, you have the remains of weapons, the remains of fortresses. You can do some level of battlefield archaeology. It's more important in the Roman world than the Greek.
Yeah.
It is obviously another way to learn something about it. And you can go and see the sites because a lot of that geography hasn't changed that much. So you can go down to, you know, some of these places and just stand in the field and be like, okay, I can understand, you know, how this would have gone down because there's a lot of it. It's just like, it's basically the same as it was 2,500 years ago.
Okay. And like, what about, so early medieval era, right? Is famous, is notorious for like, I don't know about that, how they write it. You know, we have these like religious chroniclers writing about the pagans. And we're like, yeah. And then, you know, as time goes on, there's a lot of PR spin and stuff. In the ancient world, do you ever find things where you're like, this general was like, we're totally great and we're awesome. And you're like, I don't know. Like, did that happen a lot?
I mean, of course. I mean, it's just a human thing, right? Like, we all lie all the time. Like, everything that we do is self-serving in some way. Even the people who are, you know, writing truthful histories, honestly, are doing that because they think that that's, you know, something that they should be doing and something that makes them look good in the eyes of their peers. But it's kind of interesting. It's an interesting thing about classical Greece in particular, that a couple of our main sources, so you have these historical accounts, you have Herodotus, you have Thucydides, and you have Xenophon, who are writing the history of their own period or sort of slightly before they were alive. Of their own times, and they're talking to the people who were there. And the interesting thing is all three of these guys are essentially on the losing side of the major conflicts of their time.
Oh,
so Herodotus was driven out of his hometown, which is under the Persian Empire. Thucydides was in exile from Athens when he wrote most of this history. And Xenophon was also an exile from Athens. So you have these people who are essentially, and he was supporting Sparta during the time when it collapsed. So there's, you know, all of these guys are essentially writing the history of the losing side to some extent. And that's
rare.
You know, it doesn't clear them of bias, of course. They still have their agendas and they still have their attitudes. And they're all like these rich dudes who are essentially struggle to perceive anything in ways not familiar to their position. But at the same time, they're not writing like, you know, in the Roman period, a lot of these guys are writing to the emperor. And they're saying, dear Trajan, you're awesome. You're amazing. Which is a thing that I wrote, which obviously is entirely neutral and informative, but if you'd like it, you know, obviously those guys have a very different relationship to power than somebody like Thucydides, who's sitting in exile going, right,
that's what I would want to read.
How do I explain that? And so it's a bit different. And then, you know, you find that out as well when you read contemporary sources, like, I don't know, Darius, the Persian king. He wrote this big inscription on a rock face in Iran, where he described the first few years of his reign. And obviously that's very much the kind of story where he's like, okay, he is a general and king saying, these are all the people I defeated. Here's how I did it. It was very easy.
And so it's this stupid kind of thing, guys. You know, yeah.
The gods were on my side, of course. That's the kind of story where you might be more skeptical. But if you have a counterweight to that, if you have a story that is, you know, that is showing a sort of critical approach to what happened, partly because that's an emerging philosophical idea, and partly because these people don't have anything to gain from like buttering anyone up.
Sure.
Then you
end
up with a more interesting way. I'm not saying that this means they're truthful, but it definitely means there's a lot more to be said for, you know, for what they have to say.
I definitely would give a little bit more credence to that. And what about, do you ever come across things like firsthand accounts of PTSD or like somebody just being like not totally okay after war?
So it's
like,
a very
how do they even
question.
Think about that?
So it's something that a couple of people have studied, and actually quite a lot of people have tried to find this like early evidence, because of course when we're trying to treat people nowadays who have PTSD, it's very helpful to first of all to show them like this is totally normal, right? Like this is something that happens to people who undergo traumatic experiences, not just in war, but also, you know, domestic violence, whatever else, accidents, illness. PTSD is very common. And so it's very helpful to be able to show them, look, you know, here's thousands of years ago, totally different environment, totally different civilization, but they still had that same thing. And so there's quite a lot of value in finding those examples just as a way of treating the problem, right? So as a way of treating the disorder. And so there's been quite a lot of effort tried to invest it in seeing, essentially wherever we have sources, whether anything in history can be identified as PTSD. But the problem with that, of course, is we've only formulated this as a discrete sort of illness or disorder in the 1970s, right? So before that, although you might have symptoms that are similar, it wouldn't have been something people were looking for because they didn't sort of connect those particular symptoms and say, okay, well, if you have PTSD, you will exhibit, you know, a list of these things. They might encounter people with one or two of them or a set of them even, but wouldn't have thought that it was worth recording that if you had one, you also had the other. For instance, if you had nightmares, you also had violent tendencies and you also had, you know, all sorts of things, or had problems with addiction, whatever. These kinds of things, they might not be associated. And so you have one account that always gets cited in this context, in the Battle of Marathon, right? A very famous battle of the Persian Wars, in which one of the Athenians fought in the battle, and he saw an apparition. It's described not quite as a living person, but he saw a huge enemy hoplite come at him and strike at him, but he missed him and hit the guy next to him. And from that moment, he went blind and he never got his sight back.
Oh my God.
And this has often been cited as, okay, this is hysterical blindness. Right? We know this as a symptom.
Wow.
And, right. So you get something that feels to us very recognizable. Yeah. Like, this is essentially, you know, stress does things, changes things in your brain.
Yeah.
And the result is this kind of thing that we now call PTSD, which has this as one of the symptoms, right? One of the potential symptoms. Not everyone suffers this. But the interesting thing is, about this person, we don't hear that he had any other symptoms, right? And we don't even hear that he was very sad about it, because Herodotus went and spoke to this guy, and obviously he was like a hero to his community, right? He wasn't someone who was like shunned or had trouble like blending back in or integrating back into
his
system. No, he was like celebrated, because everyone you'd ask, he would be very proudly telling the story of how he was there at Battle of Marathon and he fought these people.
Wow.
And look at him, like, he's carrying, you know, I'm not carrying any wounds, but I can't see anything. Isn't that interesting? Like, he was celebrated. And so it becomes difficult to associate that with PTSD and anything but the sense that, okay, one of these symptoms is associated with it. But we don't know if we can really call it that when it doesn't come with, you know, these other elements, these struggles to reconnect with normal life, these struggles to integrate back into society, this, you know, the stigma that exists towards the behavior that people exhibit.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, none of that's there, right? It's just not the same.
That's incredible.
So we have to be really careful to say, like, okay, that's what it was, because it's something different in a different environment.
Totally different. Like, all these things are totally different, just culturally hard to imagine. And I know we don't have that much time left. So before I go, I want to ask you, maybe a lot of people are like, why isn't she asking this yet? Greek fire. Do we know what it is? Was it just like oil and fire? What?
So I should be really careful, because Greek fire is actually... It doesn't exist in the period that I'm talking about. This is like Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire. Uses this in naval warfare. What we do have, actually, I'm taking the chance. The classical Greeks of the late 5th century BC invent flamethrower, which is a very funny thing. I mean, they're basically, you know, you put burning hot coals on one end of a pipe with billows, and you just sort of blow it through the pipe, and you use that.
So simple.
Wooden fortifications on fire. And so they invented that, and they used it a few times to set a couple of wooden forts on fire, you know, however often that ends up being useful.
Yeah.
And so authors at the time are very animated by this. They say, well, look at this cool new thing that they invented, and they used it. And then it disappears, just completely vanishes from history, never to be seen again. And the interesting thing about that, I mean, there's some very interesting research being done right now on like innovation and what it means in ancient warfare. The way they look at technology is not the same that we look, not the same way that we look at technology. We think it's very iterative, right? You invent something and then someone else makes it better and someone else makes it better.
Yeah.
And then they come up with new ideas and they keep innovating and improving and replacing the old technology. Ancient Greeks didn't have that sense of technological progress. Right? They didn't understand, they didn't see the world as something that was getting better and better over time as people were thinking about better ways to solve problems. So these innovations don't become part of a big story in which we're getting, you know, we're improving our technology step by step.
Right.
They just become like a moment in time when somebody comes up with a solution to a problem and it's like good for them. And then we all move on and we kind of forgot that the solution happened, because if it's not the solution to your problem, what do you need with a flamethrower?
Yeah. It's kind of like what you were saying, like there's no actual like military doctrine. Here's our arsenal. And there's no like Greece as a country where all these little states are united into one thing. It's like everybody's their own thing. Yeah. So why share it with a potential enemy?
And so it has to be really, really useful and really, really sort of self-evidently useful for it to really spread. So in the period that I'm studying, what's very interesting, the Greeks invent torsion artillery, right? This didn't exist yet. So catapults, basically. They invent that around 400 BC. And that does spread actually really quickly.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
This works. And so when you say arsenals, so by the middle of the 4th century BC, you actually do have cities having arsenals because you need to store these weapons and the ammunition for them. So these big metal rods that they shoot. So that's what you put in your arsenal. But that's because that technology obviously has so many merits for, you know, defense in against siege or defense against naval assault. And so everybody wants them, right? So that's when it becomes sort of useful, not necessarily as a sense of like, oh, we've made warfare better. Actually, they think they made it worse, but worse than what you're going to have to deal with. There's a Spartan king quoted saying like he had this weapon demonstrated to him, his bolt shooter. And supposedly he just said like, oh, by Heracles, so much for the courage of men. You know, we're done now trying to play this by virtue. You know, we can't do this by being brave. Now we have to do it.
That must have felt like the equivalent of like modern drone warfare where, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So sort of like what can you do as a person, as an infantryman against this thing? I mean,
yes.
You know.
Yes. And my last question I have before we go is, are there any topics or questions that are really hotly debated today about ancient Greek warfare?
There are quite a few, but I think one of the most inveterate ones, which is really, I mean, not one that I get personally involved in because I'm not super interested in the outcome, but the big question is what it actually looks like when two armies of hoplites encounter each other in a fight. Essentially, it's just a weird thing to think like, okay, we don't actually know what that looks like. Why not?
No.
Because the sources that describe this to us, for the most part, tend to have a bit of a zoomed out vision of battle where they look at, you know, they look at the overall movements of the units and then they describe in generic terms what happens in a battle. But, you know, everybody kind of knows because everybody's been there at least one time or another, right?
Yeah.
So you don't have to describe it in detail. And also it's impossible to reconstruct because as the ancients themselves already said, like no one really knows what's going on because they're hyper-focused on not that, you know.
Okay.
They're not going to.
Cool.
Right. And so the problem is we don't actually know what these two armies, like how close everyone was together and whether they primarily relied on their spears or whether they were doing a lot of fighting with their shields, with their swords. And fundamentally, the big question that's come up in scholarship is, did this fight actually take the form of people sort of trying to stab each other? Or was there a movement to kind of push each other? Like, so just getting a mass shove going with everyone all together, walking shields and trying to shove the enemy away.
Yeah.
And that debate is basically irreconcilable because we just don't have good enough accounts to prove one way or the other whether that existed or not.
I'd watch a debate about that for sure.
Right. Yeah. Well, I have an exhaustive list of it's quite funny that we have a very good sense of what these warriors look like and where they came from and who they are, etc., and like where they stand socioeconomically. But when it comes to what they actually did in a fight, it's actually really hard to know. So we almost rely on like, you know, to some extent, we rely on like experimental archaeologists, like reenactors to essentially, you know, try things out and see what works, you know, and that can be really helpful. But it's also like, it's not quite the same thing as just reading a source, you know?
Yeah. That's really interesting. I wouldn't have guessed that. Okay. Let's talk about some of the differences between... I know we kind of talked about it a little bit before, but the differences between what we think of as Greece now and Greece in ancient Greece. And we say ancient Greece, but it's kind of a misnomer, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the ancient Greek world is something that we can use like, to kind of separate it from the modern nation state. But yeah, you're talking about these hundreds of small states, but it's not only that there are many of them that are all completely politically autonomous, but it's also that they're spread over this huge area. So you have Greek states, you know, in Spain, southern France, in Italy, like especially southern Italy and Sicily, you have huge numbers of Greek states in them. There's, you know, a couple of Greek states in Libya, in Crimea, you know, in Cyprus. There are Greek states essentially all around the Mediterranean, especially on the eastern half. And so you have this hugely expansive world. And like, while most of the accounts that we have, most of the surviving material focuses very heavily on Athens and Sparta, which are obviously in the mainland in what is now the mainland state of Greece. this entire Greek world is involved. Like when there are big wars going on, they can be taking place all over the place, and there can be alliances sort of, you know, scattered all around the Mediterranean.
So why would, can you, I'm sure it varies a lot, but why would these states go to war with each other or go to war with, would they go to war with each other more often or with places outside of the Mediterranean, you know?
So that really depends on where they are, I guess. I mean, obviously the states that are on the fringes of the Greek world that are sort of closely interacting with populations that are not Greek, they are going to have much more of a situation to handle, which can be very, you know, sometimes they're very friendly relations. A lot of these states are essentially treated as peers, right? So you have alliances and wars going on with peoples of central Italy, peoples of Thrace, which is now like Bulgaria, the Illyrians who live now in what is now Albania further north along the Dalmatian coast. Obviously, the Greeks who live in Crimea, they have to handle the Scythians who are living in what is now Ukraine. All these people, obviously, you know, the Libyans, these people, sometimes they can be friends, sometimes they can be enemies. Yeah. There is clearly no sense in which these people are in any sense of sort of culturally incompatible with Greeks. You know,
okay.
you get to know the locals essentially because you live there. And that is something that can help you or it can be harmful to you. It just depends on how you manage those relations and what kind of position the local population takes. And the biggest example of that, of course, is the Persian Empire, which is the superpower this time. So you have this huge, huge empire that is the largest empire that has ever existed up to that point. And of course, it's initially sort of in the Greek mind because it is expanding west and it's subjecting territories, including some Greek states in Asia Minor, which eventually Persian Wars. But even then, you already have Greek states that are seeing this as an opportunity to build alliances with very powerful allies. You know, you have Greek states that see this as, you know, an opportunity to settle internal disputes by essentially bringing the Persians in to do it for them. And so there's more sort of open-minded, I wouldn't want to call it open-minded maybe, but like there's sort of open-ended approach to the arrival of this new power. It's really not somebody thinking like, oh no, there's like an alien invasion or anything. This is just another big player that you can use in your own sort of your own geopolitical scheme. You can just kind of include them in some way.
I never would have thought of a Greek state using Persia to get at another. Can you tell us about that? That's fascinating.
Oh, yeah, I mean. There are many, many different interest groups that are kind of constantly going to the Persians, basically for help. So this is something that the Greeks are constantly doing. In the time of the Persian Wars, it's mostly going to be like exiled groups, deposed rulers, and people who are sort of have some interest in essentially having an external with a very large army. Put them on the throne, and in exchange, of course, you know they'll promise to be loyal subjects, which is actually TBD. But fundamentally, you know, you're saying, "I'll be a friend of yours if you help me get back into power." So you get quite a lot of people who are Greeks, you know, thrown out, and who they immediately make a beeline for the Persian court and say, "Help, help! I'm being repressed."
Naturally,
naturally, because where else would you go? Like, there is no one else in the world who is more capable of helping you in that situation, and you can promise him something. Like you can say, "If you put me back in charge." You know, that's expansion for you, right? That's that's free real estate. So to some extent, you can very easily see people negotiating with the Persians.
Yeah.
Later on, once the Persian Wars, I mean, the Persians obviously lose and they get driven out of mainland Greece. And then, in fact, even their control in the Eastern Mediterranean gets rolled back a bit. And so at that point, the Persians have an interest in trying to reestablish control over some of the territories that they lost. And that is something they're perfectly happy to negotiate with Greek states about, because that means that the Greek states are going to do the dirty work for them. So from that time on, what you're seeing is all the Greeks are going to the Persians to say, can you give us money? Because you have essentially, in their perspective, infinite money. Because we have very expensive wars going on over here. You have more money than anyone in the world. Give us your money and we will, you know, help you stabilize your Western frontier. Allow you in some cases even to regain control over some of those lost territories and start levying tribute again. And obviously for the Persians, this is like a win-win because it means that the Greeks are weakening each other with warfare. And meanwhile, we'd no longer have to deal with this prospect of losing more Persian lives, which was a big problem of the Persian Wars, of course.
Yeah.
You know, when you want to do the job yourself, you're also running the risks yourself. So for them, it's like, okay, well, if you guys want to do that for us. So what happens in the Peloponnesian War is that first the Persians start funding the Spartans, basically. So they give the Spartans money to defeat the Greeks, the Athenians at sea, because that's something the Spartans can't afford to do. But for the Persians, it's not that difficult. Nice. So essentially, they just overload them with silver so that they can finally take on sort of the immense expense of naval warfare. And then later on, after the Peloponnesian War, you know, time and again, these states would just go to Persia and say, look, I mean, this state is oppressing us, or this state is expanding against our interest, or this state is threatening your interests.
Yeah.
And if you give us some money, we'll solve this problem for you.
It makes like complete sense, but like, I've never heard of that before. That's wild. I feel like that would have happened. Did that happen for a long time? Was that like quite often?
Yeah. It's basically from the end of the Peloponnesian War to Alexander the Great. So it happens for about a century. This is like a very common thing. And embassies are constantly going up to the king and coming back with his response. It's like they meet each other on the road. There are some very funny like incidents of like people who are traveling up to, you know, the Greeks think the capital is in Susa, actually it travels. But so they say they're going up the road to Susa and they meet the ambassadors coming down from the king. Just like, what are you...
Hello there.
This kind of thing. But like it happens for a long time. And in fact, towards the middle of that period, so we're talking about the 380s BC, a very great Greek war has happened, the Corinthian War, which has destabilized the situation in the West because it means a resurgence of Athens. And the Persians eventually step in. They fund the Spartans again. I don't want to go into the complexity, but at this point, basically the Persians are funding a Spartan fleet to destroy an Athenian fleet that the Persians funded, to destroy a Spartan fleet that the Persians funded to destroy.
Oh my gosh.
Fundamentally, the Persians are behind everything, that they're trying to solve the issue this way. And so what they do is they impose on the Greeks this treaty, which is called the King's Peace. And it's called the King's Peace because it's not an agreement between Greek states. It's literally the king's agent, a satrap, who comes down to the Greeks and reads it out to them. This is the peace that you're signing.
Oh.
And what that treaty says is... all the Greek states must remain autonomous. And what that means in practice is none of you Greek states can form an empire by subjecting other Greek states.
Oh,
and that is guaranteed by the king. So he says, if you violate this treaty, then those who have been violated by it, those who are making war against you, I will support them with ships and money. And
wow,
essentially a pay to win cheat. So, you know, at that point, it's impossible for any Greek to try and subject others. Now, that sounds like an imposition. It sounds like a sort of semi-conquest, like the Greek states turn into sort of dependence.
I mean, a little bit,
And they're kind of aware of that. But when the Macedonians rise, so when you get this local power coming into to dominate the Greek world, what you see a lot of these Greek states do is actually say, like, let's all band together and go to the king and go to the king of Persia and say, look, we preferred the way that you manage things. So can you please help us defeat the Macedonians?
Oh,
because
my God.
The Greeks prefer to be under the Persian guaranteed system of autonomy than under Macedonian rule. So, you know, a lot of these states, Thebes and some of the islands, they're essentially signing up for further domination by the Persians in order to avoid domination by the Macedonians.
And this just went on for about like 100 years or so. So maybe that's why it kind of, I feel like that's so lost almost in our overall non-Greek historian view of
it's a long time, and it's a thing that you know, obviously when any period of history, obviously you only learn about the greatest hits, right? You only learn about the big moments. I am embarrassed to tell you how little I know about American history because I don't live there. So there's quite a lot of stuff that, you know, you kind of have to say, okay, well, what's the important bits? And it's clearly been decided at some point that the important bits of classical Greece are the Persian Wars, the Peloponnesian War, Sparta versus Athens, and then the rise of Macedon, right? I mean, that's kind of fair enough. But there is a lot of complexity to that. And there's a lot of other conflicts going on in between those big phases or even at the same time that make it so that, you know, you can infinitely sort of zoom in further and it becomes like a fractal situation.
Yeah. Interesting. I've never heard of any of this before. And where in the time-wise does the movie 300 take place in all of the stories? That, like, you know,
So 300 is about the Battle of Thermopylae, which happened in 480 BC. So this is kind of at the beginning of the period that I study, which is the stage of the Persian Wars, is kind of where I come in. And okay. It's also more or less the start of narrative history. So before that time, we have very little in the sense of like written sort of accounts of what happened, you know, year on year or with particular kingdoms or states or whatever. So yeah. It's actually very hard for us to trace the history before that time. But from the Persian Wars onwards, suddenly there's like bright light on everything. So we can actually see what happens. And we have quite a bit of detail, especially about those battles. So
yeah.
300 sits, or the story that 300 tells, sits at the very beginning of the period. And then basically the conquest of Alexander the Great, 150 years later, that's that's kind of the end of it.
Okay. And I know you've talked about this a little bit, but what is your overall opinion of that movie? Is it totally bonkers, or where does that sit?
It's pretty bad. I mean, obviously, I'm on record in a lot of different places saying this. It's a movie that is fundamentally obviously based on real events. So, the sequence of things is fairly uncontroversial. You know, there is a 3-day encounter between Persians who are invading Greece and Spartans and their allies who are trying to stop it. So fair enough. In that sense, that's what happens. And they do so at this place called Thermopylae because it's a geographical bottleneck. It's where you stop an army that tries to march into Greece. And this is happening throughout history. There are so many battles of Thermopylae. There's like 2 dozen of them. The most recent. Yeah, no, just a huge number. The most recent battle of Thermopylae is 1941. So the Anzacs and British tried to stop the Nazis marching into Greece. Where do you do it? It's Thermopylae. It's always Thermopylae. So in that sense, that's fairly, confident. We can say that that's what happened. But then they add just a whole bunch of fantastical elements, some of which are obviously, stylized violence, whatever. This is very influential. It's very cool to watch. Other parts are more sort of, derived from the particular period in which the graphic novel was written in the 90s, and then the movie was made in 2007. A lot of it is informed by the idea that obviously America was involved in wars in the Middle East. They had this very clear sense of who the enemy was, and there's that kind of bleeds into the way they tell a story about stopping, a quote unquote Western group of people trying to stop an enemy invading them from the East. Like these kinds of things become very politicized just by virtue of when they're made and what kind of things are on the mind of their authors. And so there's a lot of that's really unsavory, or at the very least, just very unhistorical.
So was it really that clearly defined? Or is that what you're saying? Like when they were, that battle actually occurred where it's like, these are the ultimate bad guys. It wasn't the same sense.
No, of course not. No, even, and this is always worth reiterating, even the main account that we get from the period, which is the historian Herodotus, he is willing to credit the Persians with all sorts of wonderful achievements. Like he believes that they are one of the peoples who achieves great things in the world. There are many peoples like that, the Egyptians as well, and the Scythians and the Indians and whoever else. Anyone he knows, his purpose is to record great things. And he's very explicit from the outset. It's not just Greeks who do that. And so he admires the Persians for their engineering skills, for the logistical organization, for their management of this huge army. Some of their morality he clearly appreciates. He gives examples of when they behave in a more sort of moral way than the Spartans. So there's all sorts of things. And he even makes this argument, which, he's clearly already aware that his contemporaries might not believe him. But he's making the argument that if the Persians win and start controlling certain areas, it's not like they would actually snuff out local customs. It's not like they would destroy local cultures and political organizations, et cetera, and replace it with their own, because the Persians don't do that. Like they want obedient and subservient people. They don't want little clones of themselves.
They're more like the Romans that just are like, we technically rule over you, but be yourself. Okay.
Well, to some extent, but even the Romans had much more of a sense of like, okay, well, we're going to build, our own cities and capitals that look very Roman, and we're going to introduce you to Roman systems of administration and obviously religion, reintroducing all these things. Yeah. The Persians just didn't do that at all. They kind of left people to their own devices for the most part. And so even democracy, Herodotus says, when an earlier rebellion of the Greek states in Asia Minor, in what is now Turkey, was repressed, they were allowed to keep their democracies, right? So this is something that he explicitly says, like the Persians are fine with democracy as long as you pay your tribute, as long as you're open, but not in rebellion. And so for contemporary sources, it's really not a question of like, oh, there is some kind of, as I said earlier, like this sort of alien invasion, this idea that there is something irreconcilably other that's coming at you. And when it eats you up, like your way of life will be destroyed. I mean, there's nothing like that. I mean, people, as I said, are inviting the Persians over. Not everyone thinks they should be resisted. And those who do, I mean, they kind of know that what they're doing is trying to assert themselves rather than fighting for something like a way of life or a cultural system or a political system. They know that they can quite possibly just keep on living the way they are, except having to pay tribute and homage to the king of Persia. Even after the Battle of Thermopylae, there is a moment where he sends envoys to Athens and says, you want to be a democracy? Be a democracy. I'll even give you more territory. You know, I'll let you have all this if you choose my side, you know. And that's not empty boast. You know, he did that with other states. So so there's
trying
much
to wrap
less
my mind around this.
Yeah.
That's just
it's the way we tell the story, right? It's about enslavement. The Greeks themselves already use those kinds of words, right? So when they talk about Persian conquest, they refer to it as enslavement. That's the word specifically that they use. But what they mean by that is essentially a loss of autonomy, right? So they mean if you're paying tribute to another state, if you're paying some of your own revenue over to some distant king, they consider that to be unfree. And therefore, as a citizen who is under that kind of system, you are enslaved. And so they refer to all the subjects of the Persian king as his slaves, which is not because they are literally enslaved. It's because they are not free, right?
Even that was a different concept then. That's crazy.
Well, I mean, enslavement is also...
I mean, using that, nobody today would use that word without meaning what we think of it now.
Right, exactly.
You know, if you're writing, but does remind me... Even in the medieval era, you still have that concept of paying tribute, like England paying tribute to France for some of their French lands. Like, that's so mild, but they still considered it like, oh, they lord over us. Who do they think we are?
Exactly.
Start a war. That's just wild. I feel like the imprint of World War II on the global psyche and everything after that, with like each side really is trying to impose their way of life and totally annihilate the other side. And
Then
the Cold War, like free markets versus communism and all these things where people since then is so imprinted in our psyche that it's really hard to think of these societies not functioning that way.
Yeah. And I mean, I do hasten to add, like, we mustn't whitewash them entirely in sense of like, we mustn't sort of pretend that the Persian Empire is all peaches and cream. Like they have this sort of carrot and stick method, right? Well, they will say, okay, if you just submit to us, then you can keep your way of life. You can keep your temples. I will even, you know, the Persian kings sacrifice to Athena. They sacrifice to Greek gods. They really don't mind. You know, they acknowledge local customs because that keeps people satisfied, you know, as long as their way of life is not threatened, it's easy to accept an overlord, right? But if you resist, then you have a big problem, right? If you resist and he manages to conquer your territory, he manages to subdue your city, whatever, horrible things are inflicted on those populations and absolutely unspeakable things in the sense of even the ancient sources are sometimes really quite coy to try and describe in detail, but there's mass deportation, there's mass enslavement, there's mass castration in some cases. There are quite horrific things. Obviously, all conquest comes with enormous loss of life, sexual violence, all these kinds of things. Yeah. And the Persians are absolutely not shy to apply that as a terror method, you know, even as a way to say, we are punishing you like this so that others will submit, right?
Like
so that others will learn the price.
Yeah.
And so they can be really horrific. And you specifically see this as well with, you know, I mentioned earlier, this Darius puts up this big inscription boasting about how he conquered and defeated various usurpers and rebels. And he always, when they have a claim to being king, he has to prove like, no, I'm the king. You're not a king. So when he captures them, he doesn't just kill them. Like, he will mutilate their bodies, you know, cut off the ears and noses and then impale them or crucify them. And these kinds of like very explicit forms of horrific punishment, because they're not just dealing with enemies, you know, enemy armies, whatever, but they're dealing with rival claims to power, and they can't abide that. And so we're told that Leonidas, when his body is found on the battlefield, Xerxes goes and travels the battlefield, and he gets this pointed out as like, this was the king, this was Leonidas. So he has his head cut off and put on a spike, right? It's really just, not out of anger. It's because that's what he's supposed to do. Leonidas is a king. Well, you can't just get away with that. You can't be a king and resist Persia and, you know, just be buried with honors. That doesn't happen. No, your bird food because you have to make a point, right?
Yeah, you have to show.
Exactly.
Interesting.
And so,
but yeah.
Yeah. If as long as you submit, I mean, life is pretty much
you submit. That is still such a crazy idea of, I can't even imagine that concept today. The idea of like, oh, someone's just going to conquer you. Just submit and you'll be fine. Like,
oh yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I don't even think, yeah. That's crazy.
It's a very hard thing to wrap your head around, but obviously, you know, this is something that a lot of people have often done in order to deal with conquest, is just to kind of, you know, try and bear it as best they can, which is often the only thing you can do, especially if the enemy is overwhelmingly powerful. And I think most people are kind of expecting that when the Persian Empire comes knocking, and with all of its resources, all of its manpower, you're obviously going to think, well, what is the point of resisting?
Yeah.
And it is quite striking that the Greeks managed to, or the Greek allies managed to pull it off.
Yeah, this is so interesting. I feel like I'm learning so many things I never even considered before. Okay, why would different states go to war with each other? Was it just over like who gets to be in power? Is this as simple as that?
So there's a lot of different reasons. I mean, the traditional view has always been, and this is something that Herodotus himself sort of mentions offhand as a sort of characterization of Greek war, is that they're always fighting over borderlands, right? So there's all these small states. They obviously have a lot of different states on their borders, and there's going to be marginal lands where they're disputing ownership. And that's certainly something that happens every now and then. But what's very interesting is that in the cases where we know about this, it's notable that those lands are really marginal, right? Obviously, the boundaries between a lot of these states are you know, mountain ridges, essentially, or like spines of really inhospitable
land. Oh, sure. Yeah.
And so what you're dealing with is not like some rich valley, you know, thick soiled, fertile land. You're talking about like really marginal grazing areas, or even like overgrown areas that have been left, you know, essentially barren for a long time. There's one war that happened over a stretch of land that is prosaically called the Brambles. I mean,
this isn't,
you know, we're not talking about, you know, prime farmland here. And so, so the argument that follows from that is that actually, while they may be fighting over the farmland, what they're actually fighting over is who's actually top dog here, right? Who is actually going to be able to subject the others to their will? Like, who is the stronger partner within this sort of boundary? Like, which side has the superior will and force? And that seems to be what a lot of these disputes are actually about. And when you get later on in a historical period into these bigger conflicts, like between Athens and Sparta, it's very notable. They don't take territory. They don't actually conquer anything. They subject other states to their unequal alliance system. So they're expanding their influence.
Okay.
But they're not actually taking territory. They don't seem to be interested in taking territory. What they're doing is they're establishing their own place in the pecking order. If Sparta says, I am the hegemon, like I'm the leader of the Greek world, but Athens is rising and is getting richer and more powerful and has all these island states that they control because they rule the sea, then eventually Athens is going to say, no, you're not. You're not the leader. We're the leader. And these wars are very much over trying to establish, you know, who deserves more respect, who deserves to be followed, who is going to be a reliable protector of others, who you go to if something's happening in your state or with your neighbor, between you and your neighbors, who do you go to for help? This is the kind of thing that they're trying to establish. So importance, it's about status and honor, and those kinds of intangibles seem to be more important a lot of the time than this kind of raw strategic interest that we tend to take for granted. Like, oh, you know, fighting over resources, fighting over land, fighting
the
over
bramble,
timber, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Would you say that it kind of compares a little to, now, obviously there are major differences, but a little bit to the beginnings of World War One, where you're kind of, Austria's like, I am in charge of all of this stuff and I will not forgive. And Germany's like, but hey, I have an army now. I'm a thing now. Is like the Sparta and Athens, was it kind of like that a little bit? Like just an arms race and a military building race, or?
Yeah. So obviously not in that sense, because as I said, they don't really have an army. They don't really have a military. It's very difficult to imagine it in those terms of like, you know the Kriegsmarine are becoming more and more sort of powerful and the British are becoming very nervous about it.
Yeah.
But you do have, from the 5th century onwards, the Peloponnesian War, you do get a narrative which is much more based on this idea that states that are dominant are worried about states that are on the rise, right? So there's this tension between those two things. And that obviously absolutely has to do with like wherever you can get more influence, wherever you can expand your base and hold sway, that is where you expand your power and where you change that balance, right? Where you affect that way of seeing yourself in the world. And so in that sense, I guess it's similar to World War One, at least in that sense that there were many different fronts in which people were vying for influence, right? Like wars that are happening in Africa and in the Middle East at the same time, and all the seas all around the world, down to South America and everywhere else. Because all these states had fingers in so many pies and they're trying to kind of establish that they are the ones who hold sway in that region. And if you come in and try to, you know, build a foothold, then they're going to be, you know, they're going to be upset about it. They're not going to let it happen. And so that's, you know, with the Peloponnesian War, definitely that's what's happening. But I think we shouldn't be too quick to assume that that's a normal for Greek wars, just because the Peloponnesian War involved the largest constellations of these Greek unequal alliances, these Greek hegemonic states that had ever been seen. And so in a way, the fact that they had lots of different interests all over the Greek world and beyond, it's only natural because they were at the height of their power. And later on, a lot of these conflicts end up sort of collapsing inward a little bit because the states just don't have the power to, they don't have the reach essentially to have that kind of, you know, similar to European states in World War II having far less of a conflict in their colonial holdings because, you know, some of the states that are involved, like Nazi Germany, just didn't have colonies. So there was nothing to fight over there, right? That was just, you know, the Italians maybe got involved in Africa, but otherwise you didn't really have, you know, the French and the British worrying that the Germans were going to come and you know, take away their colonies in South Africa or wherever else. So there's a very different, and obviously, you know, Japan was doing this quite a bit in the Pacific, but you're fundamentally talking about a different kind of scale of conflict once these states have to shrink based on the losses and the lack of, or the loss of power that they suffered in previous conflicts.
Okay. And okay. Sparta, we're talking.
Turn on some lights for a second. It should be a little bit more natural.
Perfect. Yeah, let me just actually plug in my laptop here for a second because I think it's like, I don't know why it's dying early on me all of a sudden lately. Okay, we're bringing up Sparta a lot. And so I have to ask, there's this idea of we're talking about there's no real professional military standing and all this, but we have this idea of Spartans, you know, oh, from birth or from childhood, they're trained to be these military warriors. That's like the first thing people think of Spartans. Is that true?
So it's not true. We had to crush all the dreams, all the delusions. We do have sources telling us that Spartan education begins at 7 and that they are sort of taken, like in the sense of not really taken away from their families, but they spend most of the day in the company of their age group. So they get together, they get thrown in with a bunch of other boys and they get raised together by their peers and by the sort of supervisors who are themselves still young.
Interesting.
And so that is something that happens at quite an early age. But this idea that they get sequestered from their family or taken away from their homes and they never see them again because they're brought up in barracks and trained to fight, whatever. Firstly, no, they don't. Like they see their parents all the time. That's definitely clear from a lot of anecdotes, a lot of source material.
That's good.
They probably just sleep at home, right? They spend the day in these classes of boys with these so-called herds. And secondly, we don't actually know what their training entails. And certainly until they're about 12 or 13, there doesn't seem to be any training. I mean, they're basically just hanging. Like they are maybe getting up to mischief. Like they're getting outside. They might be practicing some hunting skills. They might be stealing food to kind of supplement their diet, which they're encouraged to do. There is some regulation of their way of life, like what their beds look like, what their clothes look like. But they don't seem to be undergoing any training until they're teenagers. And when they are receiving training, that training is athletic, right? They are being trained in fitness, essentially.
Okay.
That's where did that come from?
Where did that come from? The myth that everybody thinks, like these ultimate warriors? Is that just movies, somebody's interpretation?
So, there's a lot of layers to that. I mean, the first layer is essentially that, that the sources we have on Sparta are almost all from outside Sparta. Mm-hmm. And there are other Greeks writing about the Spartans, partly because they admire it and partly because they think it's a bit weird. And so what they're doing is they're emphasizing difference, right? So they're focusing on the things that are not like the way they are at home. And so, as I said, the other states, they don't train their militia, right? They don't have any kind of collective, organized education or training for war. And so they look at the Spartans and they go, wow, these guys are a bit nuts. You know, they're really focused.
Yeah.
Because they're doing anything whatsoever, right? Because that's already in contrast. And so you have Aristotle looking at them and saying like, oh, you know, because by his time when he's writing this, when Sparta has already been defeated and they no longer have power. But he says, you know, once upon a time, the Spartans were better than everybody else, because not because they were so good, but because they trained and no one else did. Uh-huh. And then as soon as everybody else started training too, their advantage was gone and they were immediately defeated, right? So it's literally just like, I mean, I'm always talking about the parable of sort of the one-eyed man, land of the blind. I mean, they were doing a little bit of physical exercise, a little bit of social conditioning, and in wartime, perhaps a bit of basic formation drill, but that was already much more than the other states were doing. And so you get this sense that, oh, the Spartans are taking this really seriously.
Yeah. Right?
I can't imagine anyone doing more to do with warfare than the Spartans are doing, because they just don't know a world of professional armies, right? They don't have anything to contrast it against. So that's the first layer. And then later you just have, I mean, for most of history, Sparta is admired more for its political system than for its military. So people think it's a very stable state and they admire that. They think the constitution is very well considered in a very similar way to, you know, this inspired the founding fathers in the US. They were mostly looking not to Athens, but to Sparta and Rome for the idea of a balanced constitution, right? With checks and balances, with different layers of power, et cetera. And so that's their inspiration, is Sparta as a political system. But more recently, you have a bunch of fiction, essentially basically Gates of Fire, which is the Stephen Pressfield novel, and then 300, which go all in on the idea of Spartan militarism as an example of the ultimate military state, the ultimate state where everything is devoted entirely to warfare. And obviously you can cite some ancient sources that, like I said, they have a very distorted view on this, and that's what they say. Like, they will say, Sparta is not a city, it's an army barracks. Okay, sure, Isocrates, whatever. But fundamentally, you know, we don't believe that, because we know a world in which professional armies exist, and we know that Spartan training, for what we hear of it, is much, much more modest and much less onerous than what modern militaries or any military historically really goes through if it's professional. So we shouldn't listen to that. But the result of those kinds of statements in the sources that somebody like Stephen Pressfield or somebody like Frank Miller can sit down and say, right, how do I imagine the Spartans? Well, I mean, if they're living in barracks and devoting their lives to war, which they're not, but which the sources sometimes say, then I'm going to imagine them as the U.S. Marine Corps. You know, that they're writing USMC fan fiction in fancy dress.
Yeah.
They're writing about modern military elites, very professional soldiers who choose to live a life of preparing for war, and they're putting that in the clothing of the ancient Spartans. And so it's very funny to see that that becomes then like mandatory reading in military academies in the US. It's like, look at the Spartans, they live just like us. Like, yeah, because they are a youth in this story. With the Spartans, not the other way around.
That's interpretation. That origin story would start like that, with people from the outside looking in, and they would interpret it that way. But it makes sense that it's not quite what we think it is.
And of course, it makes sense, because the Spartan military forces are still a militia right down to the end of their history. Right, they never develop a professional army. So the Spartans are just guys who are citizens. You know, they're landowning citizens. They live in an oligarchy with a property threshold, so they have to be large landowners. So they're all basically like rich, you know, rich farmers, whose enslaved population do all the work. So they are leisure class landowners.
Okay.
And they live in a certain way, which has been decreed to them by the law. Obviously, in war, they are meant to serve their country in war, but in peacetime, they're still meant to serve their country in other ways. That is what they're meant to do with their lives. So there's all sorts of things that they can do for the good of the community, and that's what they're striving for. But that means in wartime, they're the citizen body in arms. They're a militia. They're nothing.
Sure, yeah.
There's no, you know, outside of, if there's no war, there's no Spartan army. It doesn't exist. You can't go to Sparta and point to where the army is, right? There isn't.
Right.
And so, you know, maybe the Royal Guard might be hanging around the ephors, you know, pick up some guys, you know, if you need doesn't some count. Muscle, there are some guys hanging around, you know. That's the extent, right? And so, you know, when we imagine now what a modern military looks like, that it's just different worlds, right? There is nothing like that in ancient Sparta, even when there are things like that emerging in other parts of the Greek world. So you start to have a few small standing units, you start to have these mercenary garrisons all over the place. And increasingly in the Hellenistic period, so after Alexander the Great, it's very common to have, you know, professional armies just sort of marching around the Greek world and garrisoning cities. And you know, people see mercenary service, which is essentially professional military service, as a real sort of way to make a living. Yeah. Even then in Sparta, there's just nothing like that. You know, They retain, they stick stubbornly with this idea that they are a militia. You know, it's their devotion as citizens that will see them through, not professionalism in wartime.
Yeah, everybody's got a farm. You don't have time to be a soldier.
Well, you know, you've got estates to run. You've got horses to raise. I mean, that's fundamentally what they do. They're hunting rabbits and raising horses. I mean, that's it's a good time.
Yeah, it's a great time. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show and answering all of these questions. Roel Konijnendijk, author of Classical Greek Tactics, A Cultural History. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I had a great time.
Yes, me too.